Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the People Power Politics podcast, brought to you by CEDA, the Center for Elections, Democracy, Accountability and Representation at the University of Birmingham.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us. I am Milita Cianetti, Deputy Director of CEDA, and I'm going to be your host for this episode. Today, I am delighted to welcome Marlies Glasius, who is Professor of International Relations at the University of Amsterdam and author of a new book on authoritarian practices in a global age. Welcome to the podcast, Marlies.
Thank you.
So, Marlies, your book was published by Oxford University Press in 2023, and it's a brilliant book, which opens up a new way of thinking about authoritarianism through the lenses of practice. So the way I read the book and what I find really interesting about your work in general is that it challenges our usual way of thinking about regimes as coherent entities. So we are either in a democracy or in an autocracy, and democracies behave in a certain way, autocracies behave in a certain different way. So instead, you show how authoritarian practices are not the sole remit of authoritarian regimes, but can take place within democracies and can be done by actors other than states. So you have these five very rich empirical chapters, and I suggest the listeners go and read your book. And you discuss cases as varied as people with migrant background living in democratic countries, but facing political repression from their country of origin, the practice of extraordinary rendition by the CIA, the decision making around who gets listed or delisted from the Security Council terrorist sanction list, the activities of multinational mining corporations in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the way the Catholic Church dealt with evidence of sexual abuse of minors. So to get us started, what do these things have in common? What is an authoritarian practice, and how do we know one when we see it?
Okay, so I'll give you my definition as I've developed it of authoritarian practices. As you said, the reason I wanted to do that because I think in a transnational world, it is useful, and also in a de-democratizing world, to get away from this classification of, you know, you're either an authoritarian regime or you're a democratic country. Sometimes there's then a middle category, but still I found that far too static. A practice, and I've taken this from practice theory, is quite simply pattern of actions, some sort of routine behavior that occurs again and again within an organized context. So it's not a single person doing that. An authoritarian practice is a little bit more complicated. I've kind of redefined authoritarianism because when we do it at the level of states, we tend to think of authoritarianism as no free and fair elections and or no civil and political rights. And that doesn't work when you take it to other site practices. I thought, well, what are elections? They're a mechanism for accountability. And authoritarianism for me, authoritarian practices are kind of actively sabotaging accountability. So if accountability is explaining and justifying policies and actions to people over whom you have some sort of formal power and allowing them to have criticism, pass judgment, then sabotaging accountability is instead of explaining and justifying you being secretive and lying, and instead of allowing critiques and judgments, you're actually silencing people, you're disabling voice. So that to me are authoritarian practices. I must say a lot of people who quote either the book or the article that came before in 2018, they kind of take hold of this notion of authoritarian practices to get away from regimes, but then they're a lot more loose than I am about what constitutes authoritarian practice. And I guess that's okay. I don't have ownership over what this concept means, but I do worry that kind of lays academics open to the accusation of, oh, you just call anything you don't like authoritarian. That's why I do kind of hold to a strict definition.
You make a distinction between authoritarian practices and illiberal practices, and maybe is that where some of the misuses, let's say, of your concept come from. So why would we need to distinguish between the two, and what are illiberal practices? Are they relevant to your work, or do you define them just to say, okay, this is not what I'm looking at?
So yeah, authoritarian versus illiberal is something I think people are really struggling with at the moment, as we're trying to understand imperfect democracies, de-democratization, and so on. And people use it in different ways. And I think part of the problem with illiberal is that liberal is such an incredibly broad concept that then illiberal becomes everything that isn't liberal. The way I've defined it is illiberal practices for me are infringements on the kind of dignity and rights of the individual, whereas authoritarian practices are, as I said, about accountability. So the one for me happens more at the macro level, whereas the other is really micro. And it's, to me, very similar to defining violations of human rights. The difference is that liberal practices can also be engaged in by not formally the state, by other power holders. So that's my particular distinction. I've chosen to focus on authoritarian practices because these illiberal practices, if they are something very similar to violations of human rights, I think we already understand quite well what that means. And even there's already a lot of literature on non-state actors actually abusing human rights.
Yeah, and I think you make a very convincing case to look at accountability as also a way to understand contemporary politics better. So at the beginning of your book, you say that, and I'm quoting there, that struggles over accountability have become central to contemporary politics. And that for me raises a question. So are accountability struggles new or have they intensified? So, and if so, if they have intensified, why? So in other words, are authoritarian practices increasing and that's why we should be looking at them? Or have they always been there, but we were not paying attention? We didn't have the framework to understand them as authoritarian.
Well, I think in a way it's somewhere in between. I think the vocabulary and the implicit understandings of what power relations should or should not be, can or cannot be, do change over the ages. So I think you always have contestation of power holders, but in early modern times, that could be kind of in a very polite way as a request to the sovereign, or it could be the opposite. It might be quite bloody. Then I think from the 19th century, more revolutionary vocabulary comes with such requests, with such contestation, with Marxist, communist, anarchist vocabulary behind it. And I think in the late 20th century, as democratic norms have really sunk into even non-democratic societies, I think there is much more of an understanding of the notion that power holders of any kind should be explaining and justifying their behavior to us. So in that sense, I think accountability demands in that sense, with that vocabulary, if you need to explain and justify, that I think is new and that has really taken flight maybe since the 1970s or the 1990s. It's difficult to pinpoint it very precisely.
So I think that your focus on practices poses a particular challenge to regime studies in general, but particularly to those of us who study democratic regimes, who might be less used to think in terms of authoritarianism in a way. Because once you start looking for authoritarian practices, they're everywhere, even if you define them as accountability sabotage. So you don't kind of blur them into anything we don't like, right? So it's not only governments, but also non-state institutions, private institutions that shape many citizens' lives, our workplaces, private corporations, pretty much all power holders in any aspect of our social life are liable to at least try to evade or sometimes actively suppress accountability. And so thinking about this in a context in which we are worrying about the decline of democracy as a regime, how should we understand the proliferation of authoritarian practices? Are they a prelude to open attacks to democratic institutions? Or should we see them more as an alternative way in which democracy is perverted or eroded, even without visible institutional change?
I think the notion of prelude or perverted, these terms you use still kind of imply that first we have a perfect democracy, and then, you know, these perversions creep into it. Whereas I think we should recognize that even in our own societies, there has never been perfect democracy at a societal level of our institutions, really. And I don't even want to say democratized, because I think that's even a heavier concept, but kind of really completely internalizing the notion of accountability. Certainly, if I think of of my own university context, in the 1960s, 70s, there's a real protest culture and students had an enormous amount of power. And since then, that's been clawed back and there's kind of less accountability at our level. So I prefer to talk of currents or strands of authoritarianism rather than this notion of first we have democracy, then we have a tax.
So you don't see your work speaking to the autocratization literature, or do you think that the autocratization literature in general makes the mistake of not understanding what the starting point is and then maybe overstates the extent of democratic regression?
Yeah, I think it would be the latter. I mean, there is de-democratization. There are, I think, more threats to democracy now than there were 20 or 30 years ago. But on the other hand, maybe other elements in society have gone kind of in the opposite direction. And I'm thinking, for instance, now of corporate accountability, which I think is much more of a societal norm. So I don't think de-democratization is a myth. It's absolutely there, but its starting point of perversion of purity, I think, is a little bit problematic. So we need to somehow develop measures of, you know, is it getting worse? And I think the literature on de-democratization, it tends to focus very much on the state and state institutions. Part of what my practices approach can do is take a more sociological approach and saying, you know, the degree to which our institutions are democratic is something to do with democratic culture or accountability culture as well.
Yeah, and so like just to push you on this a last time. So how many authoritarian practices are too many? If we still accept that there are democracies and there are autocracies, but that you have all these authoritarian practices actually permeating the way in which even democratic institutions work and actors playing within democratic fields work, at what point the authoritarian practices accumulate so much that accountability becomes a sham and we should talk about the democratic regime as something else?
Yeah, so I don't think we can say 27 is too many. I don't think that's the sort of answer you were looking for either. I think one of the things that help us measure this is the extent to which something appears relatively isolated and shocking. And so then, as I said, secrecy and disinformation are part of my definition. And then if and when such a thing comes out, it becomes a scandal, there's maybe a parliamentary inquiry or something, there's some sort of self-rectifying mechanism. If that is still in place, then maybe you don't need to be so worried. At the point that it kind of becomes tolerated by the population, this is the way it is, there's kind of some sort of permanence and acceptability to it, that's the direction where it becomes too much, as it were. Yeah. But I still think that can sometimes be the case in some areas and not in others. So to give just one example, I think the extent to which not just private corporations, but also the state invades our privacy at a digital level, the extent to which, it, you know, secret services hoover up our data to find out whether some of us might be terrorists. I think that's an aspect where most Western democracies are beyond the line of what I think is democratic and accountable practice, but it doesn't turn them into authoritarian regimes.
So you've mentioned already more than one corporate actor, so I wanted to ask something about that. You have recently published an article in which you take these authoritarian practices lens to a transnational corporation. It's entitled 100 Years of Authoritarian Practices, United Fruit and Its Banana Plantation Workers. And we can put a link to the article in our episode notes. And again, it's another kind of brilliant piece of work. And in the article, you show how multinational corporations not only do deals with authoritarian regimes and may help them survive, which is something that's been more thoroughly, let's say, investigated, but they themselves can be the ones that directly engage in authoritarian practices. They can be the drivers of authoritarianism. And in fact, interestingly, the term banana republic, which is now often used very loosely to mean a country with an incompetent government or a useless government, originally it meant a country whose economy was so dependent on banana plantations that their politics was pretty much controlled by the corporations that owned those plantations. So in a way, kind of in their original use of the term, the agency of corporations was very much present and it's been lost in the usage. But now if we take the potential of transnational corporations to be authoritarian agents, their power over our economic lives, lives and political lives in many places. And then add to it the unprecedented capital accumulation that we are witnessing globally that puts certain companies and certain individuals outside of the reach of the state and of democratic institutions. What does this mean for the prospects of building and maintaining democratic accountability? Like, are we doomed?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the extent to which corporations, including multinational corporations, aren't going to be engaging in authoritarian practices is very variable. And that depends, I think, largely on their incentives for wanting in some way to engage authoritarian practices. And I've kind of listed a bunch of very likely incentives. If your business model depends on cheap, dirty, dangerous labor, that could be an incentive. If you're in the extractive industries and you're kind of very dependent on very specific land and you just need to get your hands on that, you're likely to need to be doing business in authoritarian regimes. So there's a bunch of scope conditions that are going to make that more likely. I also think there's scope conditions that are going to make it less likely. So if you depend, for instance, on very highly educated and motivated professionals for your business, that might make it less likely. Or for some reason, you have a long-standing company culture of transparency, you're going to be less likely to engage in authoritarian practices. So that, I think, is the first thing to say. Then secondly, I think capital accumulation, kind of, we know it correlates negatively with, and then I go back to regime level, levels of democracy, but we don't understand the mechanisms for that very well yet. So whether it is the bigger the company, the nastier, for instance, or whether it's levels of income inequality that are the driver there for de-democratization, we don't really know very well what is going on there. And I think we just need a lot more research.
What strikes me is that multinational corporations, they operate at a global level by definition, but they would encounter different contexts. And so what you say in the article that they have, like, you show how United Fruit have adapted their the ways in which they operated and also the kind of authoritarian practices that they used in different contexts over time also applies over geography, in the sense that the same multinational corporation might have very different practices in different places. So does that mean that the regime intended as the kind of state-bound unit makes a difference in that sense, that multinational corporations would operate in specific ways in democracies and in different ways in autocracies, or there are other dimensions that make a difference? So there'll be some portions of the population that will be at the kind of receiving end of authoritarian practices also within democracies more than other portions of the population.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot more to it. So autocracy, democracy does make some difference. But precisely in that United Fruit article, I looked at a plantation that was kind of spread across the border between Costa Rica and Panama. And for most of the period, Costa Rica was a formal democracy and Panama was not. And it didn't seem to make that much difference to the practices. Another thing that's going to make a lot of difference is whether the product in question is close to consumers and has a lot of value to consumers. At some point, we got a demand for bananas that should be more ecologically produced, but also workers' rights should be better protected. You got premium bananas that said they met those specifications, supply and demand, but it didn't work so well for bananas because it turns out most people want their bananas to be relatively cheap. When it comes to diamonds, it seems to have a kind of much stronger mechanism because it's such a high value-added product. So there's a lot more going on than in which country they operate.
Yeah. So it is, to put it crudely, about capitalism. You don't use the word a lot, but there is a big kind of literature about the relationship between capitalism and democracy and potential conflicts between the two. Is this about how capitalism has developed and is changing and what effects it has on the accountability and possibilities for new actors or growing actors, corporations, to frustrate accountability for profit motives? Or is it not such a systemic problem?
I think some authors treat it in that manner. I take a slightly different approach. I'm interested in the corporation as an organizational environment. So that's why it is in the same book with the Catholic Church and secret services, to kind of get more of an empirical operationalization of this notion of authoritarian practices in an organized context. What does that context mean? How do employees in a firm imbibe certain cultures and ideas about appropriate behavior? So I'm less interested in the corporation as standing for capitalism with a capital C. Of course, corporations are different because they have a profit motive, but there's also a lot of literature that says corporations are more than just profit maximizers. And I personally find them most interesting in their organizational capacity.
Yeah, I think that works very, very well also to make these comparisons that at first sight seem wild, but then kind of they bring home really how different kinds of actors that operate in different, very different kinds of also territorial contexts and territorial articulations can pervert accountability. And just to close, I'd like you to give an example of silencing, secrecy and subterfuge, which are three authoritarian practices that you discuss, but with in mind the idea that people might want to know how to recognize them and how to fight against them. So what are silencing, secrecy and subterfuge, and how should we respond to them, and how should we try and recognize them and push back?
Let me give you an example from my own country, the Netherlands. One of the kind of big state institutions here that has been through a major scandal in recent years is actually the tax office. And as it often the case with authoritarian practices, it begins with a behavior that is illegal or at least frowned upon. And here, the tax office, in relation to a particular tax break in benefits, child benefits, or rather benefits rebates for childcare, they were looking for fraud and they were really engaging in ethnic profiling as they were doing so. So, people with exotic surnames or who were born outside the country were really kind of monitored and treated very harshly. That in itself could be an illiberal practice. But then on top of that, when it become uncovered, they are losing documents, destroying documents, and the Ministry of Finance lies about this in Parliament. And there's also silencing. So some of the whistleblowers who brought this out in the open were actually suspended by the tax office. So that combination was a lot more secrecy than there was, and disinformation than there was silencing, but it was also silencing. That would be kind of a very concrete example of, if you see that combination, but that's still at the level of national state institutions. It might also be that your child attends a boarding school, and we know because boarding schools are quite closed organizations, there can be abusive practices there. It might be bullying. And if you see that a complaint is then being treated by evasion, by lies, but also by somehow silencing the people who are first bringing it up, that's when alarm bells should start to ring.
Yeah, that's very interesting. There is a book by Sarah Ahmed where she discusses complaints, and she says that complaints are the ways of knowing institutions. Once you lodge a complaint, you become the problem. You see how the institution operates. So in a way, she's not talking about authoritarianism, but kind of points to the same kinds of ways in which institutions work. And that, to me, also points to the importance of looking at institutions and organizations as institutions and organizations. So where will your study of authoritarian practice take you next? So are you looking to look at different kinds of authoritarian practices now and by different actors, or what are you working on now that uses this framework?
I'm actually kind of switching topic a little bit and engaging in some new research that is not directly about authoritarian practices, although I'm certainly expecting to find them. As I already mentioned, it seems to be the case not just that there's a virtuous cycle between democratization and economic equality, but also between de-democratization and increasing within-country inequality. So I've become very interested in inequality and specifically the kind of very top of the wealth distribution, the super rich. So I'm beginning to do some research on the tax politics of the super rich, which is not just whether they pay their taxes, it's about whether they pay money to lobbying organizations, whether they themselves engage in anti-tax rhetoric, whether they move to Monaco, and so on and so forth. So that is my new research, which there's still something to do with accountability issues, but that's also taking me in a new direction.
That's very fascinating. And also, to me, kind of brings again this transnational, the importance of the transnational dimension, right? Because you have this transnational infrastructure for wealth management, as it's called, that probably comes into the picture there. And it's got also to do with evading accountability, would you say?
Definitely,
so?
Definitely, yeah. But I think there's a lot more secrecy and disinformation than there is silencing. There's less of the kind of overt repression in new research of mine.
So thank you. We've come to the end of our podcast. And I really want to thank you, Marlies, for joining the People Power Politics podcast and for talking to us about authoritarian practices and about your new exciting work. So hopefully we'll have you again in a few months or a year to know more about how that's going. I really want to encourage the listeners to read your work, which I think fundamentally challenges the way we tend to think of political regimes as self-contained, coherent units and the most important units to think about political reality, and instead brings in all these contradictions, non-state actors, transnational dimensions that are really, really, really important to shaping contemporary political life. So thank you very much. I am Licia Cianetti, Deputy Director of CEDA and the host of this People Power Politics podcast episode. I've been talking to Marlies Glasius, Professor of International Relations at the University of Amsterdam. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the People Power Politics podcast, brought to you by CEDAR, the Center for Elections, Democracy, Accountability and Representation at the University of Birmingham. To learn more about our center and the exciting work we do on these issues around the world, please follow us on Twitter at CEDAR_BHAM and visit our website using the link in the podcast description.